Each week on For the State, we get together three journalists to talk about the best and the worst reporting of the week, as well as media ethics and innovation, a bit like this. So if you were a fan of the late RN Media Report, rest in peace, you'll absolutely love For the State. So do tune in. We're on tonight and every Thursday at 6:30 p.m. Or you can subscribe via iTunes and SoundCloud. So Tanya Safi is senior video producer with BuzzFeed Australia, and some of BuzzFeed's, I think, biggest global videos have actually come out of Australia, and that's got a lot of to do with Tanya Safi, so I rate her highly. James Colley is creator of The Backburner on SBS Comedy and also writer for The Weekly with Charlie Pickering on ABC. He's also one of the better people on Australian media Twitter, so if you aren't following him, then you definitely should be. And on the end, we have Jeanette Francis, or Jan Fran, host of The Feed on SBS2, say no more. Moderating these radicals will be the illustrious Fiona Katauskas, cartoonist and illustrator. Fiona.
Thank you, and thank you all for coming here this afternoon. I hope you've enjoyed your day, and I hope we round it off with some interesting discussion and hopefully some laughs as well. First, before we begin, I'd just like to ask all of you guys, delve a little bit into your pasts very quickly. You've all grown up to work in comedy in some capacity or another. Was there any particular satire or satirist that you were exposed to as a child that might have contributed to this affliction? Jan, Fran, can I start with you? Cast your mind back. You're either a teenager or possibly in your tens. Was your zero to tens? Was there anything, television, print, that stuck in your mind? It doesn't have to be political.
Yeah. You know, I sort of fell into this a little bit. Like, my background is not comedy at all. Like, it's journalism. You know, I sort of did a journalism degree at UTS, then started with SBS News, and then kind of moved on to Dateline. And then The Feed was starting, and I sort of got kind of plonked into it. So when I, like, go through the annals of my brain, it's always related to journos, you know, like the yarn events of the world type thing, rather than satirists or comedians, because I still, to some degree, see what I do probably more as journalism than comedy.
Ah, that's very interesting. Just contentious. Something we're going to discuss later, where journalism meets comedy and which one wins in a battle in a darkened alleyway. But now, James, to you. So was there any particular form of satire or any television shows or any...
I grew up loving early comedy. Like, I grew up watching comedy, but I think for personal involvement in it, I think my moment would be there was a kid in year one when I was in kindergarten named Don, and he would beat the shit out of me, like, every lunch. But, yeah, I know, where's he now? But
not in satire.
If I referenced a joke from hit film The Little Rascals, he'd leave me alone, and I learnt the power of comedy.
Wow, well, that is a lesson for you all. That is a wonderful anecdote. Now, Tanya, have you got any satirical or, you know, influence in your background?
Hands down, it was when the Chaser intervened with the APEC rally. For me, that was an absolute epiphany. I loved the Chaser prior, but that APEC moment, I just fell in love and I needed to be a part of it, and eventually I was.
Excellent. So you actually had a moment. You had a where you went, this is
what it was. Genius, yeah.
But you're also a journalist. You come from, you have a journalist background. Mm-hmm. So Jan said that she was, you know, considered herself more of a journalist. Where do you guys all think that, in terms of where news meets comedy, does journalism have a role in that? How much about news do you have to know?
I think you have to know. Those are two different questions. Does journalism have a role in that, and how much about news do you have to know? Journalism definitely has a role in that, because you're essentially conveying the news, and you're subject to guidelines, and particularly guidelines around, editorial guidelines, basically. So, yeah, I think, like, in terms of how much journalism plays a role in news comedy, I think, you know, once you're kind of under the umbrella of journalism, you're able to kind of make comedy in a way that's still understood as something that is informative and something that is held to account. And in terms of how much you need to know the news, I think if you're reporting on the news, you should probably be somewhere within the news. Mm. You should probably be, I guess, tapped into what's going on, and there's kind of two different ways to do that. I think part of it still exists. Like, television news is very different to the news that you see online. Mm. But I think you kind of, yeah, you sort of need to be in that space for sure.
I think there might be two different streams on it of whether your goal is to make news funny or to make a comedy show based on the news in whichever form. Like, if you're looking to make news funny, then certainly journalism has to take the reins there. It's the start, it's the driving factor. When you're trying to make a comedy show that happens to be about the news, you still want to have the ethics and integrity behind it, because otherwise no one's going to trust or care about what you're saying. But your goal, more than anything else, is to give enough information to get from the first joke to the second joke. And I always patronizingly think of it as like training a dog, that you just, you know, all right, roll over. Okay, now you get this treat. Now I need you to sit down. Okay, here's this treat. And that's how I treat it. And I cannot stress this enough. You are the dogs in this situation.
Do you end up with a different product if you were putting... if you were making the news funny or making funny about the news?
Yeah.
Do you end up with a different product in the end?
I believe so. I think the way you are building your narrative and what you're aiming towards is a different product. Like, I think that you can drift between the two different elements. In fact, I think The Weekly does that quite a bit, that there are some stories that are much more intended to be investigative, and there are others that are a bit more odd-spotty and are just fun for the sake of the fun.
Yeah.
But I think you can end up with different products there, because the different approaches will necessitate what information you find useful and what information you can cast aside.
It's funny that you talk about format, because when you said that, I'm like, right. Because in my mind, what I think we try to do is make news funny rather than say funny shit about the news. It's like you've got the news and you're trying to make that funny. So there is a format there that already exists in news, and you know the kind of stuff that you want. You know the grabs, you know the stuff that, you know, happened throughout the day. There's doorstops that you kind of have to be across. So that sort of does shape it a little bit, this idea of like, okay, you've got this kind of news, now how do you make it funny?
Yeah, whereas like if you're doing particularly like the opening things of The Weekly, the first few minutes when it takes over, like when it's talking about news that happened this week, whatever one big story is or a couple of smaller stories, you're following the narrative of what happened in a lot of cases, but you don't necessarily need to get into the nitty-gritty for that kind of story. You want the moment of, oh, here's what we noticed, this is quite funny, and you can stick to that moment more than necessarily going through the motions of a news broadcast, because our... like, while informing is a benefit, like, it's not the major crux of what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
Tanya, how do you... you're a journo and a satirist, so how does that work for you? How do you...
To be honest, I would say I was more of, like, a gonzo journalist a few years ago. These days, I've kind of more redirected toward... The video content that we produce at BuzzFeed is kind of, when it comes to political content, is a collaboration between our editorial team and the video producers. So the political team will come together with a pitch and a story, and then they meet us and we say, okay, how do we get this across? How do we make it digestible and relatable to millennials? How do we make them give a shit, basically? And it's by making it lighthearted. And it's not so much making... we don't really make jokes per se. It's a little bit less satirical these days. We're always trying different formats and platforms. But, it's kind of just being able to reach them on their level, which is making it very easy to digest and accessible through humour.
I guess cartooning is a different thing in terms of you guys are... well, cartooning is... in a lot of ways, working with the art of the metaphor, so you can draw anything and you don't have to pay to... like, do you do something in television which involves an elaborate, you know, fantasy scene or, you know, people dressed up and stuff, it's going to cost you a lot of money, whereas, you know, to hire costumes and stuff like that, whereas when you're drawing, you can just go, oh, I'm going to put, you know, this politician's head on the body of a, you know, dragon or whatever you want to do. But it is and within cartooning, there's quite a range of cartoonists who are very interested in the news and other ones who are very interested in, don't have really any opinions about what's going on in the news or anything like that, but just like writing a gag. So you sort of get the whole spectrum in that regard.
For sure.
Mm. Sometimes I think it's like, you know, you're either a, like, in terms of that apex where news meets comedy, you're either a journo who's like a little bit funny or a comedian who a little bit understands the news. You know what I mean?
It's the same, like, we had this same dynamic, but it was 20 years ago and it wasn't news, it was magicians. That you were either a really good magician and you knew a dick joke, or you were a really good comedian and you could pull a rabbit out of a hat.
Hey, there you go. That's it. Yeah. We are the neo-magician.
Oh, there you go. Well, we've heard it here first, people, the neo-magicians. So how, when you guys are, you know, preparing what you're going to do or looking at what you want to satirise, how do you choose which issues you're going to cover? Is it based on the news of the day? Or, Tanya, you seem to work with things also that are personally interesting to you as well, and that's where you follow that a bit. And I guess maybe that's a function of you being a bit more independent as well.
Mm, we're given a lot of autonomy at BuzzFeed, which is amazing. And I run the motion pictures of Australia, so I kind of have complete creative
license. You run the motion pictures?
Yeah.
That sounds like you should be going, whoa, I run the motion pictures.
I do. That's what I do. Yeah. In the mirror every day. I do definitely, I mean, I'm personally more interested in things that do affect me or minorities. I use BuzzFeed as a platform to give voice to groups that otherwise aren't heard. And because we have such a huge reach, there are so many other media companies, but we have such a huge reach when it comes to impressionable youths. And I want them to hear the stories of minorities, LGBT issues, Indigenous issues, mental health issues. And you can bring light to those situations. To, you know, we're so saturated by so much depressive nihilism, and you know, the reality of the world is so heavy. And
the news does tend to focus, you know, as a function of, you know, on the negatives and on the bad news kind of thing.
Yeah, and that is the reality of the world that we live in. It's a very dark place. And if you bring humour to it, you get people thinking in a way that they otherwise wouldn't, and you get them interested in these dark topics, or at least to grow some kind of empathy toward a group that they otherwise wouldn't think twice about.
So does comedy... do you think comedy promotes empathy? Does satire promote empathy, or
so.
Does it depend on
sometimes
the audience?
Yeah, as a social function, like the it's, you resonate with someone. The reason you laugh at an idea is it surprises yet resonates with you. You can feel the truth in it, and you know, satire's most powerful weapon is shame, and that's what, like, it's shame towards one thing, and it's empathizing with others who feel that same feeling. So. And that is also what makes it a real dangerous weapon as well, because it is othering. It can very much be an othering thing. So that, like, it's why it's impressive to bring in unheard voices, because it's so easy, some would say, for a cartoonist, some would say, to specifically other people.
Some would say.
I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I was talking. Okay.
No. I do totally know what you're talking about. But there is, you know, and that stereotyping as well is something that is, some cartoonists would say that is shorthand for presenting an image. But you've also got to be really careful with the shorthand that you use as well.
Yeah, technically, racism is shorthand. Just not right. No, I think to the grand point, it's interesting when you're picking topics, because, like, when you think of something like the back burner, it's necessarily reactionary, because like you mentioned with working with metaphor, we exist kind of a step outside of reality. So we need you to be kind of, at least to some degree, across the story. We can walk you through the finer details, but the joke won't make sense if you don't understand the premise, and the premise is the news.
So all of this requires, you know, a level of understanding.
But that can be elitist in some regard as well, you know, and that can exclude a huge, like, potential market, which is why I think sometimes even dumbing it down a little bit really works. Because
I just hate that term, dumbing it down.
But it, sometimes you need, if you want to get a message across, you do have to sometimes spoon feed it. I guess it depends who your target audience is. You know, if you are preaching to the converted, obviously go ahead. But if you're trying to change the minds and hearts of people who otherwise wouldn't know what a plebiscite is, for example, then you just have to. And you have to get on their level to be able to get them to understand. You know, you have to speak their language, basically.
But I would agree with that, but say that you can, like, the level of presumed knowledge only needs to be a certain amount. Like, you can, if you were talking about, let's say, the plebiscite, for example, what you would need to know about it is vaguely the idea of what the plebiscite is and vaguely the idea of where the sides stand on it. And then you're able, like, we've run a whole bunch on it. Like, it would be, it's easy to put that. I don't think, like, a good measure for it is national news. Like, what would you get if you have seen the updates from Channel 9 and you haven't been particularly paying attention, you're watching something else, but those are come on? Or what would you get from vaguely browsing your Facebook feed? Like, we're not saying that you need to necessarily have a subscription to the AFR or something, which, get one. When, like, it's not necessarily that level. It's literally, though, to for a basis for something. Like, it's much harder for, say, the Backburner specifically. Like, the Weekly has a different system because it can introduce you to the story and it can take you through it. But the Backburner appears in your social feed, then disappears. So we need some level there of just you are aware this happens. And it's much harder for us to tackle obscure stories. And when we do, they don't move.
Well, also with shows like, there's a different audience, I suppose, with shows like The Feed or The Week, people are, who are interested in the news are going to, will track down that and watch it knowing what it is and that this is something that, you know, that they relate to. Whereas, I guess, differently, if you're trying to reach out specifically to people on a, you know, whether it's a campaigning kind of level, you know, or an educative level as well to an audience that wouldn't necessarily be there, then that's a different
very
approach
different.
For the audience as well.
Sure.
The brilliant American satirist from the 50s and 60s, Tom Lehrer. I'm not sure if any of you know of him, but if you don't, please look him up because he's ingenious. Said of his craft, audiences like to think that satire is doing something, but in fact, it's mostly to leave themselves satisfied rather than angry, which is what they should be. And he also liked to quote the British comedian Peter Cook, who spoke of, quote, those wonderful Berlin cabarets which did so much to stop the rise of Hitler and prevent the outbreak of the Second World War. So given those two quotes, and deeply cynical as they are, but should satire make us angry rather than... Does satire tend to make us smug? Should it make us feel angry? And can it change hearts, minds and politics? That's a triple-barreled question.
Wow.
Let's see. Launch right in there. Jan, you look like you've got an opinion on this.
Look, I watched John Oliver recently and as a result paid $100 to The Guardian. Okay, that happened. Mm. That happened about an hour ago just before I came here.
So change your wallet.
Change my wallet, exactly. I think it has the power to make us angry. I think anything has the power to make us angry, and I don't think that you have to be angry to make people angry, which is, you know, what satire, when done well, does well. What was the question?
Well, can satire change? Does it just make us feel smug?
Oh.
Is it preaching to the converted, or can it actually change hearts, minds and politics? When is the last time? Because I was just thinking before, I was talking with James and Tanya before outside about The shows like Black Comedy, which is political satire to me, you know, politics is abroad, is not just about what happens in government, it's about power relations and stuff. And one of the great things about black satire and that made it so brilliant and so different is that there was a lot of skewering of, you know, the white people, you know, the sympathetic white do-gooders as well as, you know, it made watching that often was a bit of an uncomfortable experience because it was holding a mirror up to, you know, a whole lot of different things. And I thought that was just great, just going, you know, oh, I'm just feeling like I'm shifting in my seat a bit. And so I should feel uncomfortable, you know, and...
I feel like again, this is like, it's a very broad brush to paint it with, it depends, again, on your topic and the way in which you're presenting it. But, like, something we found like that I found doing some of the longer pieces for the weekly is that satire isn't like in the trenches. It's not saving the world. It's the last gust of wind. It's that everyone else is doing real, much more significant groundwork on an issue. And what you're doing is hopefully getting it publicized a little bit more and getting a little more attention to it. Like, we were working with... we did a monologue in the last season about, like, innocence projects and wrongful convictions in Australia. And we were working on the back of decades of work from journalists, from people working in innocence projects, from all these people who have been doing real grassroots work. And that we say it to a studio audience and they clap for us doesn't make us the most important cog in it. But we are hopefully the last gust of wind, so it gets a little bit more attention. Like, particularly when, like, the weekly's format naturally draws on things that have already been in the news, things that there's already footage of. It's just bringing this back into public view and hoping that that does a little bit more.
I think the element of smugness, I guess, is because there's a particular audience that, you know, the Daily Shows and the John Olivers and, you know, possibly even the Weekly and us, look, let's face it, are kind of dedicated or you know, or they hit their mark with more than others. And the medium or the social media... Yeah, medium, I think, has to come into play when you're talking about these kind of programs, because it's almost, it's very easy to kind of view something relatively fleetingly on social media, like it, agree with it, feel good about yourself, do nothing, you know? And that's not necessarily the satire's fault. I think that that is the content's fault, whatever it is that you're watching in conjunction with the medium that you're watching it in. And because the medium's, like I said, you know, they're so fleeting, and they're to a degree saturated. You've got so many of these things coming through that it's almost like, hey, I'll like this, I'll agree with that, I'm feeling pretty good about myself. You don't actually get off the chair and put like, anything into practice.
The cabarets didn't stop Hitler, but to be fair, that ain't on the cabarets.
Yeah, it's a reflection of society, not necessarily the content that you're creating. It's just a reflection of where we are. And I think it's funny that, you know, that's from the 50s, that statement. And it's 2016 and we are living in a generation of, like, armchair clicktivists.
Yeah,
you know.
Degree, yeah.
Absolutely. But if you can just reach one out of 100 or educate one person out of 100 on something that they otherwise wouldn't know, then I think that's a massive achievement.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've got to say I'm a fan of, like, I'm reading the cynical stuff, but I'm a bit of a sucker for the belief that, yeah, it can change. It might not change, you know, 100 minds, but it might change one, because I was totally...
that John Oliver example that I gave, I debated with myself. I sat there in front of the screen today for about an hour going, what does this mean about me if I give $100 to The Guardian?
What was it? What was he talking about that made you...
He was talking about the demise of newspapers. You know...
He gave money to a digital company.
He did! But he was talking about the demise of newspapers and how it was all about, you know, it was very difficult to monetize a newspaper online, and, you know, that was coming at the expense of decent journalism. And then you had the Nauru files... you know, so I've got this, like, terrible demise of newspapers, bad. Nauru Files comes out, and then, you know, in the midst of it all, Kath Viner jumps in and says, well, if you think that The Guardian should continue doing these, you know, stories, give $100 now. And I've got John Oliver on one shoulder and Kath Viner on the other shoulder. And
now
then,
I've got you on both my
now
shoulders.
You've
and
got
I'm
going
to go home now and give $100 to The Guardian, actually. So, anyway.
But I couldn't work out if I was, like, smug or doing something about it.
No, well
maybe I'm
this
like,
is...
am I just a smug lefty? Like, hey? Maybe I'm like a smug active person. I can live with that.
But it is very interesting seeing the demise of that hard news in so many ways. And I'm old, so I've been around for a long time and said, you know, I'm back from the days when newspapers were, you know, fully legitimate, ongoing things, and no one ever thought they would end, and just that they were a real focus of information. And it's very interesting that we've sort of, you know, there is a lot of discussion about the post-truth world that we're in now, and that there doesn't seem to be a lot of, you know, that fact-checking is optional as well. And where does satire, when satire is supposed to be, you know, sort of the role of satire is to sort of somehow, ideally, cut through to the truth of something by, you know, illustrating the bullshit. Mm-hmm. And, it's interesting at what point, when news isn't around so much, you know, where are we getting the facts from to be able to skewer them in some way? Could I get the... I've got it
only one audio-visual thing I want to show, although I would like to I'll put some of your stuff up, but could I get that cartoon popped up, please? Now, this isn't one of mine, but this is one from the New Yorker this week. It says, it's a cartoonist. Stop. That Trump cartoon you came up with this morning has just happened. So this seems to be something that is... certainly for cartoonists, this is something that we've been experiencing for a while. When Tony Abbott became Prime Minister, there was a discussion amongst a lot of... Like, there's not many political cartoonists in Australia and we sort of talk a fair bit with each other. But there was a bit of a discussion about, is this the death of satire? Because it felt like every day Tony Abbott was doing something that you just thought, you couldn't make this shit up. And when it's your job to make crazy shit up and he's doing it for you, like, it was just like...
I was working for the roast back then with the Chaser crew and we felt exactly the same.
And yeah, and it was really... And you're looking at Trump at the moment as well and the stuff that he is doing, you know, is astonishing. You just... Yeah, it's extraordinary and nothing you could make up would be... He's going to top you every time. So my question to you guys is, how do you take the piss when they're giving it away?
I would like... How
do you work with this stuff? Like, how would you tackle Trump as well?
Well, I think Trump's a special beast, but like, I think in any element, it's firstly mixing the signal and the noise up. Like he can bite as many, like for Abbott in this case, he can bite as many onions as he wants. Like you can.
I didn't know where you were going to go. Bite as many. Yeah.
Do that till your boots are filled. Like, let's talk about the other things he's doing. He can munch. I have no problem with that. You can eat whatever vegetable in whatever state of cooking you want. But when you start cutting funding to essential services, that's where it's an issue. For Trump, I think, because the problem with this is that, as we mentioned before, the power is shame. And what do you do when someone doesn't have that, where it's like bullets to Superman, I think then you have to look at where the power structures are coming from. What does affect him? And in this case, like in the United States, it's the media. It's that he gets all of his work. He uses earned media. He doesn't pay for political advertising. So where your satire needs to be aimed is not at... I don't want to compare him to Superman because that's gross. Like, not at Trump, but at the structure that allows him, at the shame that must be being felt inside genuine Republicans, in a media system that propagates what he's saying, both so everyone can be outraged at it and that you come to look at what bad thing he's saying, thus getting his message out further. Like, I think there are elements here to attack, and to think that you have to find something weirder than whatever he said to be the satire against him is just picking the wrong target.
Oh, no, I don't mean weirder. I just mean the things that they do are so extreme. Well, I suppose I'm thinking about cartoonists, and cartoonists are about exaggerating, situational, creating some sort of... And it just felt like then with Tony Abbott and with Trump, and, like, this is the sort of... I guess this is about cartooning this thing, so you guys have a different approach. But just that sense, it's like, that nothing... Like,
you just sort of have to look a bit further. Like, when there's somebody who is, you know, so much of a satirical genius that they are doing your work inadvertently for you, I think, screw them, just look past them. You just have to work a little bit harder to exactly what you said. Look at all of the structures that end up propping up this person. That's where you'll find...
There's only, like, one headline that's banned from the back burner, and it's satire takes a day off or whatever, because if that's the case, why are you in the office? I think you shouldn't... There's no reason to put things like that together. And I feel like it's exactly the same point. It's... You just find the different target.
Tanya?
To be fair, we aren't... I wouldn't say that BuzzFeed are satirists. We do use comedy with news. We lean less towards satire, though. So, for example, we did a video in LA where we got children to quote Trump quotes. Mm. And it was hilarious. It was for people who otherwise wouldn't necessarily be politically affiliated or not necessarily interested in Trump, or they've heard enough about him already. It was another way of reaching them. And it brought new light. So we're constantly looking for formats to work with and using more kind of comedy than satire in that approach. Another one was, I guess, comparing, like, Trump quotes to other political leaders in the past, and people like guessing trivia, and it's so confronting that Trump would say this, or you know, you're comparing Trump or Hitler, and you can't tell who's who, and that's hilarious, but it's so depressing as well. And at least like afterward, you're just like, what the fuck? What kind of world are we living in? You know, and hopefully you're left wanting to fight for it. I hope a little bit.
He is losing.
He is losing.
He will win, but he's losing.
Yeah, he'll lose, but he'll go down. He'll try and take as many people down with him as he can.
Yeah.
Anyway, so now one thing that's been discussed recently that you alluded to before, James, the curse of political correctness. That's something that I'm not meaning that you did. people's complaints about you.
You're bringing me onto my point. Repeal 18.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, this is what we're all. This is the actual point of this discussion. There's often, there are some groups in the media and in society who claim that, you know, you can't speak honestly anymore, that we're all victims to political correctness. What's your response to this in terms of your work and stuff? Do you feel that there is any veracity to these accusations?
Absolutely not. Like, this is such a garbage argument. You're not looking for a freedom of speech. You're looking for a freedom of speech without criticism. Mm. There aren't people who say these things who are then put in a jail in this country. Mm. It doesn't happen. Mm. Hell, you usually don't lose your column, or if you do, you start up a new one in another paper in a couple of months and are on a panel on Channel 9. Like, you can do these things, and there's no real recourse of this. What you're looking for is a freedom without criticism. And political correctness, as much as that used as a buzzword, is a kind of occasionally stuttering, but mostly an attempt at inclusive politeness so people can be engaged in your debate. If you have a problem with that, it really says more about you than it does the structure around you.
Yeah, and it's funny that the people who are crying, you know, the most political correctness, and that they're being, you know, stopped from having an opinion and stopped from voicing their concern are the ones with, like, some of the biggest platforms to voice their concerns.
And also, yeah, the irony of two huge champions of freedom of speech who never stop bleating about it are, you know, Chris Kenny, who sued the Chaser for, and yet then appeared on their show shortly afterwards, and just mental blank, someone else's suit. David Lineham didn't sue, but he had a wow attack because someone pulled a wicked camper outside his house.
And that's sort of a perfect example. You know, David Lineham, he wants to, you know, repeal 18C, for example. And he says you can pretty much say anything and it's your fault if you take offence, because you can just not take offence and be chill and everything's fine. And, you know, when someone tells him to suck a big bag of dicks outside his house, which effectively they did, he got the shit. Because that's not a very nice thing to do. So on some level, yes, there is a line as to, you know, what you can say and to whom you can say it. But I feel like the people who are shouting the loudest don't know where the fuck that line is.
And also have the glassiest jaws as well. It seems like...
I don't understand how you write the phrase, "I am being silenced," in your national column without it triggering an alarm in your head.
And, you know, and this is sort of going a little bit off tangent, but, you know, when Sonia Kruger came out and said that, you know, we should ban all Muslim immigration, and of course there was a national outcry, not because Sonia Kruger has a concern. Everyone has a concern. We're all concerned when there's a kid that shoots up a, you know, police officer in Parramatta. I'm concerned, but there has to, you have to kind of draw a line between shit that's not backed up, shit that is utterly divisive, and shit that's not helpful. When something is not helpful and divisive, don't say it, because it's not helpful. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but ironically, these people are given the biggest platforms as well.
And she was appearing between the anthropomorphic block and the sale on mops.
See, James, you've just given a terrible secret away that you were actually watching that program at the time.
I am paid to watch that program.
That justifies it.
Handsomely?
No, but it's your tax dollars.
What? Our tax dollars are paying you to watch commercial television? This is a scandal. We need Andrew Bolt. Oh, no, he won't get outraged about that, will he? So when it comes to satire, how far is going too far? And is there any? Have you got any personal taboos about lines you won't cross or issues you won't cover?
Lines?
I would like as a general rule, like as with any kind of thing, you don't want to be an asshole, you don't want to be cruel. You want to, wherever possible, play the ball. As much as you, like, if someone is a figure in charge of an institution, they often come to represent it when that's what you're talking about. But other than that, it's I don't think it's any different from anything else. It's what we were talking about before, that, again, you can say what you want, but you have to be prepared for the feedback, and you have to listen to it, or you're going to lose your audience more than anything else. Like, that's really the survival game for you. It's, you can be a jerk, and you can be tone deaf to everything else, but don't be surprised when the rest of us move on without you.
Yeah, I think the more powerful a person is, the more shit you can say about them and feel good about yourself. And I think, like, if there's a line that you don't cross, it's, you know, just taking the piss out of, I guess, weaker people. Don't punch down, punch up. That's I think, a, you know, pretty simple general rule for when you're kind of taking the piss or satiring.
One thing in cartooning that, for me as a personal line, is no fat jokes because they're dumb and they take, which really happened with Clive Palmer. And so a lot of cartoonists constantly doing gags about Clive Palmer being fat. It's like, we know he's fat. That's got nothing to do with anything. What are his policies? And that became a really cheap, easy gag that lots of cartoonists did. And I think that's a sort of, with cartooning as well, you, for me, I try also play the issue, not the person, and as well try and know stuff about the what you're talking about as well, because sometimes you just think, oh, I've got to kill a gag, but it's actually not technically right. You know, when if you look down at politics,
sucks.
That is, oh,
that's
God,
the
it's so good, and you go, yeah, no, just can't use it. So
when reality gets in the way of a really good joke, that's hell.
Yeah, but yeah, it's interesting the representation, and a lot of with when Julia Gillard was in power, a few of the cartooning is like 95% male profession, more around the world. It's just it's a kind of bloke's game. But I was interested to see, or not interested, I was pissed off and disappointed to see that quite a few male cartoonists really played on taking the piss out of Julia Gillard having a big ass, as if that was something
a thing.
Yeah, you just go, yeah, but what are you saying about anything else? And it was like, that was sort of the belittly thing. And some people did earlobes as well, got some weird fixation with their earlobes, which
take
is
it.
Really strange.
But
it's my contraceptive pill, everybody. Let that be on the record.
It calls you?
No, I really cares. My God, it is an alarm, and I deliberately... We're not going to go into this. Anybody wants to ask questions?
Thank you for coming to the Walkies.
Yeah, exactly. You've learnt something new today. Okay, now we're going to get onto social media. I'm not sure how much time have we got left. About 20 minutes, okay. No, that's good. We've got time, and then we'll have some questions at the end. Now, the rise of social media has obviously seen a big change in the way people receive and consume, for want of a better word, I hope, news. What role does social media play in terms of your work, each specifically? Tanya, I know that you have done videos for BuzzFeed going to the BuzzFeed Facebook page. So they're sort of effectively published for, what's the word you published there? Released? So how does that work for you? What's your relationship with your Facebook, with the BuzzFeed Facebook page or social media in general for your work?
Well, you know, BuzzFeed is a cross-platform global network. So it's not only Facebook.
Cross-platform global network, do you have that on your business card?
Yes. Nah.
Little super villain.
Thank you. That's the nicest thing you've ever said to me. So it's not just Facebook, it's social media in general. And, you know, once again, we're talking about having different audiences. We mostly are speaking to millennials. 70% of our target audience are millennials, mostly female. And that's what they use. They use social media. So, of course, everything we create is directed to that platform, and we keep in mind that it has to be quite easy to understand, as I was saying before, which I, you know, put down to digestible, accessible.
Time-wise, I suppose that's a constraint on the time that the length of video and things like that.
Some, you know, hard-hitting subjects we allow a bit more time, but generally, you know, a few minutes per video. We have the memory and capacity of goldfish these days, and it's like it's actually alarming. It's, you know, people are, if they're looking at a video for more than 30 seconds, that's considered quite good now, and it's just decreasing every single day. So you need to have something that's really impactful and
Get it right up front. So you need,
yeah.
And so how many is Facebook your main thing?
Facebook and YouTube, really. I mean, most of the videos that I create are posted both on Facebook and YouTube. They change slightly, not drastically. We do use other platforms like Snapchat, Instagram, tiny bit. But we're constantly experimenting. That's kind of the nature and beauty of BuzzFeed, that we're always trialing different platforms and seeing what works and what doesn't.
And does BuzzFeed work with, BuzzFeed Australia work with BuzzFeed in other countries and sharing sort of information much about that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so I mean, our mothership is LA, which I will be moving to shortly, actually, in 3 weeks' time. And we have about 200 video producers there right now, and we have two in Australia, so kind of just drastically different there. And we are constantly correlating with them, and they share some of our content across their platforms as well. It just depends. Sometimes we have very Australian-focused stuff. So, like, at the start of this year, I created a word association video, Aboriginal people respond to Australia Day. That was just shared exclusively on BuzzFeed Australia, of course, because a majority of our followers are Australian, or at least interested in Australian identity. Yeah.
James?
Yeah, it's like, particularly for the back burner on this, we mainly exist on social media. People rarely will go to the SBS comedy page, which is good because it's ugly. But it's like we exist on it, and it's a necessary element of it. Like the headlines for the back burner are always a strange kind of haiku where you're trying to fit them in. So you need to get across the topic, the premise of your angle, and the punchline in the like 7 words that Facebook allows before it starts cutting off your. And sometimes you're like, oh, we have a really good joke here, but it takes like 2 lines to describe, so we need a better joke. And so that's a necessary restriction on your work, but it's also just the medium you're working in. It's
and also work teaches you to you can work, like honing jokes in a certain way.
Yeah, exactly, well,
like,
yeah.
You know, like the 140 characters of Twitter as well, it is a different, you know, can require a different craft in writing it. But with the other work that you do, like, for example, with The Week, that is a television show on a slot, you know, on television, and Jan Fran, yours, the feed is also both. How does what other social media ties into sort of or augments the actual, you know, locked in time television shows that you've got?
Well, we're sort of 1 foot on the train, 1 foot on the platform, and have kind of been that way since our inception. We are a TV show. Technically, we're a TV show. We're a TV show that makes content that goes online. And where's...
So is that breaking it down the segment? Because, you know, Mark Humphrey's piece, Talking Prejudice, last week, so there's little sort of units within your show that...
That's sort of exactly how it's done. It's a TV show that is essentially produced in very separate units that each unit can then be pulled apart separately, put online separately as a separate piece of content.
And was that conscious decision in creating the show
to
start off with?
That was a conscious decision in creating the show. I think in the 3 years since the show has started, there have been so many developments online, so many developments in the way that people produce, particularly video, that it's sort of been our biggest asset and our biggest liability that we are what we are, because we haven't really had the scope to harness all of the changes on social media because we're still a TV show. And the stuff that works online doesn't work for TV. The deadlines for online don't work for TV. So you're essentially kind of having to look at producing 2 different products almost for the same story. We don't have the resources to do that. Like, ain't nobody going to do that. You know what I mean? So you have to try and come up with something that works for television but also works online in a way that is, you know, shareable. And it's not as easy as it was, believe it or not, 3 years ago when you could just make those segments.
Yeah.
And you could put those segments online. And, hey, it sort of worked. Now I think you have to really curate, especially video content online. And being a TV show.
So what has actually changed? Like, how is that?
Well, I think you know, videos are becoming shorter. I think there's a little bit more personality in the videos. I think it's like certainly the subtitles has been a really big change.
I was just thinking, like, it's been troubling me how much that is going to fuck me up when we go back
to the
weekly.
What
are the sub? What do you mean by the subtitles?
Everything's subtitled. You read the joke before you hear the joke, which is terrible. Oh, that, comedy.
And so people can look at it silently on their phone because we're not necessarily clicking on the video.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
So this is, and also I guess things are then shrinking to the screen, like because you're wanting, I guess that would affect the visual thing as well because you don't want a complicated.
Exactly. Yeah, it affects the visuals. It affects, you know, particularly with timing. If something's a really timely issue, you want to be able to kind of, you know, get something out, like come up with an utter bit of 90-second genius in 2 minutes and, you know, get it out there so that people who are, you know, following that hashtag at the point where that hashtag is hectic, click on your shit. You don't, that's not how television works, you know. So there's all these things that you sort of, yeah, have to kind of think
the
about.
The beauty of James, it, though, is that it's, like, in comparison to television, is obviously that you have this world, like, this absolute plethora, and there's no limit of who's going to see your videos. Mm. Yeah. So sometimes you might make an LGBT identity-based video that reaches, like, people in, you know, Japan, who like, someone's grandmother who somehow saw it on their feed, you know. The nature of sharing something, and because obviously we're constantly looking at numbers, something that might seem more like, sometimes I create a video and I'm like, this might do okay, and then it gets 300,000 shares. We see a reach of 80 million people, and it's about a minority group, and it just brings me to tears. Like, it's like this platform is so extremely powerful because it's so accessible. It's just everywhere, and anyone has access to it who has the internet.
James does. What about the week or?
Well, we're geo-blocked, so we don't get that. but like, no, it's.
Well, they've got you on iView as well, which is another like
true,
different
yeah.
format for.
Like, but again, I think it's very interesting how you mentioned this because like, partly we are encountering these changes. So you have the format looks different when you're building for television. It's a different element, and really like I feel the way the weekly socials works is that the show is often. If anything, like it's not so much you see the thing on YouTube and it's the first time you're seeing it. It's you've watched the show and you're like, I'm going to share that video, and then you go onto the page for that. It's still that relationship.
But it's still also like in the week also has sort of identifiable chunks that you can lift out.
Yeah, exactly.
Or an investigative piece or
yeah, and we've had like our biggest pieces have been things like working with Adam Briggs on a few Indigenous issue stories and things like that have been like some of the biggest share things, and they're often the shorter pieces. And you know, it's hard to get people to watch an 8-minute monologue, but when they do, like that's also been some of our biggest stuff. So it's more like. In some degree, it's a little bit of magic that you just have to produce the best thing you can. And there are things you can do to customize that can help you a lot. But particularly when you're in this format where you're going from the television to the internet, you just have to make the product initially as good as you can and then see how you go.
Can I just say as well, one more beautiful thing about social media, and it's ironic because I was one of the last people in my friendship group to get Facebook. I was so against social media, but I'm in love with it now because you just skip all the red tape that television gives you. And I've worked in television, and there's so much bureaucracy, and there's so many people that you have to get through. And, you know, at BuzzFeed, it's just like, cool, do it, give it a try, give it a shot, let's see how it goes. And if it flops, it's not seen as a failure. It's just seen as a learning curve. And you're able to tell all these stories that you just don't hear anywhere else.
That's the magic of working on a network that nobody watches. You can try things, and if it doesn't work, everyone's just like, don't worry, nobody
never noticed it anyway.
It's fine.
It's interesting you mention that, though, because like, this is another way social media has really changed it for the weekly. Is we come on, like, a new story happens on Thursday, and we're on your next Wednesday. Mm. Like, for some cases, we have to abandon the story and just say, that's too old now, it's not worth touching on. But there are other times when something breaks, like, the day before, and it's a big story. Bronwyn Bishop dropped during our first season when that, well, like, flew. But, like, when that story happened, it came to the record, like a day before the record, and we genuinely had to say, what's a joke we can make that Twitter can't make? And that's a real consideration. End up being put Tom Gleason in a helicopter, which not many Twitter accounts can get. But That's the kind of situation that it changes the game, not just for how you go on there, but how you can write and what you can say and like what jokes are just done by the time you get on.
Yeah, that's really like, it's so funny you should mention that, because like you're writing a piece, like I write day pieces. I don't know what piece I'm going to write during the day. I come in at 8:30 in the morning, something's happened. You go, okay, this is the piece we're doing. You have 3 hours to put together a script. And, you know, the first thing I do is go to Twitter and I see who has made the funniest jokes, and I don't do those because they've already been taken. Done, and you're just like, fuck, just reading down the Twitter stream of jokes.
I'm just going to have to wind it up here because we've only got a couple of minutes left, and we just wanted to get, if anyone's got questions in the last 5 or so minutes we've got left.
Yeah, just a question for the whole panel. How do you get comedic value out of the really dark stories, and how do you, you determine whether or not to have satire on things like, you know, genocide and war and stuff like that?
I would say for this argument, like, you're always going for the importance of the story. You want to talk about it because it's so significant. But often there are tricks of the trade, particularly for like the back burner, which is inherently silly. Part of what you have to write on for this is we know that we shouldn't... We're not going to go into the details of the Nauru papers. We're not going to do that because it's not what we're good at. What we can do is ride on the public sentiment of the feeling of the idea, look at the wider picture of it, or look at it in a different angle. So, like,
or the way the politicians have reacted to it.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
You skew the power structures around... insert terrible thing happening here, rather than talk about the terrible thing happening here in a funny way.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
Putting a laugh track on a crash.
Yeah. We've got our editor. Sorry, this is just what he does, like, because he's hilarious. Every time he comes to show us a story that's about something utterly terrible, he puts the Benny Hill music. And as a joke. So we're all sitting there watching this story like... Oh my God. And then it's like, like underneath it's like, hell, you know, but yeah, that's just what he does. Yeah, probably not. I'd
say. Can you hear me? Because I'm doing this.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not sure what the question is exactly, but a couple of years ago, I think there was a survey in the States where the most trusted journalist in America, apparently, this might be apocryphal, but the most trusted journalist in America was Jon Stewart. So I suppose my question is that something for young journalists to aspire to? Or, you know, is there a paradigm shift taking place because the sort of false balance, he said, she said, journalism has lost all credibility, that satirists really are the new Walter Cronkites?
Take it away, James.
Yeah.
Hey, we all go.
As Walter Cronkite, we play on the format, and like particularly for everything, every bit of satire I work on, we rely on strong and good journalism because that's what we're building upon. I think that because what we try and do is make hard news more accessible, naturally a bigger audience will become aware of it. And hopefully it tempts them towards the other issue. But I think for things like surveys of trustworthiness, that will definitely skew that. I think, as always, as with all my life advice, it will come from some form of a comic book, that with great power comes great responsibility. And you have to understand that if that is your role... Like, the reason Jon Stewart had that for so long was he had a very good record of calling out bullshit.
Yeah.
And he was very good at that. But if something came out and you realised that he was, like, loading the dice, it would go away really quickly. And it's that same game.
It's interesting with John Oliver as well, but we were talking about the... on the social media thing, how I often see his 10-minute segments shared... Maybe it's also I'm older, so I look at longer things, and people I'm sharing it with are also older, so we can sit through a 10-minute video. But that does seem to be shared quite a lot, and he actually digs into things and invests. Like, so he will have that, it's funny, and but he will also actually dig into the guts of an issue. And there is investigative, there is journalism.
You would love
serious
the
journalism that has gone. Oh, I do watch the Week. No, I've watched, of course I watch the Week, but there is serious journalism that's gone on underneath that, and it is a big chunky segment that, you know, you can actually learn quite a lot out of too.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not surprised that you know, John Oliver was like one of the most trusted news sources in America. I think, you know, to sort of be a trusted news source, if you have that reputation, like you said, of just kind of consistently calling out bullshit, I think people will trust you. But I think it's very dangerous, because journalism is, there are certain standards that you're held to. There are editorial standards. You cannot take money from people. You have to abide by, you know, a certain kind of guidelines in terms of how you report. You have to be impartial. I think if you're not a journalist, the question is that, and I don't know the answer to this, is, you know, where do those standards kind of come from?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Like
how are you kept in check?
I've been lucky to be on a bunch of editorial policies that have kind of kept that in check, but there are times when it's not like you see satirists where you, like, particularly when you know the story, you're like, that's not quite right.
Exactly.
But, like, even for John Oliver and Jon Stewart and The Weekly, we have incredible teams of journalists working within the show. Like, they are the backbone of it. And while, like, we are investigating as comedy writers as well, like, we rely so heavily on those teams. And I think people like Oliver and Stewart hide a massive organisation behind them because they're the anchor.
You guys are really good at recognising when, you know, you've got something that's going to go off with a certain, like, younger demographic, how to grab people's attention and hold it, and how to make things blow up online. What do you reckon the bigger, more traditional players like ABC, the newspapers, could learn from you guys in that space?
You know, I always feel like a little bit uncomfortable when, like, the ABC Twitter handle, like, tweets like a GIF or something. Because, and, you know, because it's like, it's your ABC.
The, like, news intern isn't a real intern.
Yeah, it's, you sort
it's
of,
like, when it doesn't even work,
like,
at the ABC.
Joins Facebook.
It's like when your mum joins Facebook.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah. The first thing they can do is get rid of that Snapchat logo.
The ABC.
Yeah, the ABC's Twitter with a Snapchat logo. I do not want dick pics from the public broadcaster.
But, you know, I think that they're in a bit of a pickle, particularly, you know, programs like, for example, 7:30. You know, 7:30 has had a traditional audience of, you know, relatively skewed older. It's a relatively serious news program, and I think the move online has benefited or works better for a kind of a younger-ish demographic who have the scope to kind of, you know, experiment with video.
Yeah.
You know, experiment with different sort of formats. If your format is so solid and your audience is so solid, it's very hard to attain the flexibility needed online in order to really reach the audiences. So, no, they can't be us, is what I'm trying to say.
Like, it's also an element of, as always, it's what you're producing. Like, the Don Dale footage was everywhere, and it was because it was an incredible and shocking story, and it deserved to be everywhere. And I don't think, like, there's a huge number of millennials tuning into Four Corners, but that's still got around, and it's on the strength of the work. And that's really what dictates everything.
Also, young people don't watch TV.
Yeah.
Don't say that. That's our jobs.
They don't.
No, they don't. We have a lot of older people who
it's
love
very,
the show.
Yeah, it's just a very different world, I would say, ABC, particularly compared to BuzzFeed video. Yeah, very different.
But that's not to say that they can't. I mean, there's ABC videos that have enormous reach, but they're traditionally, they're just very good stories in a known format. Do you know what I mean? So I think, like, the element of flexibility is really important, and I'm not sure that it is easy for, you know, bigger programs to kind of fall into that.
What you do is you take your story and then take a different reporter and have them react to the story on camera.
For the first time.
Yeah, they're seeing it for the first time.